Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That was the voice of our indomitable founder who brought this group of Brieflys together. And 2 days after Valentine's Day, we all send our love to Brian, wherever he is. And we hope he's up above and not down below. And to Sheila, his stalwart partner. We love you both for the progressive spirit and sense of civic responsibilities you have fostered in all of us. This is Tuesday, February 15th, 16th, 2021, in the year of the traitors and the failed coup attempt on January 6th. It is also the February of the great snow. So briefly, is any harrowing or not so harrowing stories of the great snow of 2021?
Well, the power stayed on. I was so pleased. I was on my knees giving thanks for that.
There was snow on the beach at low tide. Some of you who live close to the water's edges of our island home perhaps saw that. So you always know that's a big snow when we get snow on the beach. And it reminded me of a years past when my children were young and we once rolled a snowman on the beach, actually made a snowman on the beach. It was mostly sand colored.
Quite fun. Nice. Yeah, I went and surveyed all the tire chain sizes we had. The one vehicle that sports those tire chains is in the shop right now. So I was like, how can I swap them down and get out of my driveway if I have to? Fortunately, I was able to get out chains free yesterday. So
great.
Yeah. Yay.
Well, for those of you who live in the Pacific Northwest, we're used to snow that's sort of the consistency of concrete. And this snow was about as light and fluffy as snow can be. So it was actually gorgeous snow. And, most of us hunkered down for a couple of days. And today it's virtually all gone. So a little interlude of white here in the midst of winter for Vachon.
Yeah.
How did you survive and the horses?
The horses did fine. Of course, you can't scoop poop when there's snow on the ground. So it's going to be a bit of a mess for the next few days getting it all cleaned up. But my driveway is extremely steep, so I have no problem coming down. But boy, going back is forget it. You're not coming back up. So
Isn't that the park at the bottom of the hill
exactly.
kind of plan that you have to fall back on?
Exactly. I did. I came home. This is several years ago when I was still working. I came home from a trip in my uniform and my nice, boots and everything. And I could not get up our hill. I mean, couldn't even begin to. So I finally parked it at my neighbor's and slogged up the hill in my good boots. And I was not a happy camper, I can tell you. Anyway.
The joys of living in the country.
Right? That's right.
Yes. Well, you've already heard from the Brieflys, but let me do some introductions. With us this morning in the Gene Bosch studio in bustling and bodacious downtown Vachon is our master of the virtual mix, Zoom modulating sound engineer, and steady hand on the stick as we fly through these snowy weeks is Truman O'Brien.
Good morning.
Are your Trumpster Army buddies ready to buckle up their uniforms and defend the Constitution?
I don't think so. I am just astounded at how quiet the fellows are. There's been no comment, no political commentary at all. I mean, zero. The only thing I heard was that I posted that joke that Trump left a note for Biden that said, "I still won." I mean, I won is what it was or something. And one of my buddies said, "He did." That was all. That was all I heard. So, of course, my response was, "Yeah, I'm not surprised that he did leave that message."
Right. There you go.
Yeah. So is silence from them a good thing or is it something?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think they've kind of figured that the jig is up, that we're done with this craziness. So I hope anyway.
Good. So out of the land of magnolias and staying secure in a home on the island of Madronas comes the academic analyst whoops, analytic academic, let me get that straight. Social worker, poet, backup singer, former all-star shortstop for the Dixie Debutantes, Lynn Kerrigan. Lynn, what insurrections have you been planning in your corner of Ellisport?
Oh, I'm glad you know me that well to know I'm always plotting. And I actually have been doing some small insurrections, and perhaps I won't be jailed for them, but perhaps I will, since justice seems to go for the low-hanging fruit these days. So one of the things I want you all who live down here in Ellisport to know is that for years I have been the secret founder of the Ellisport Liberation Front, otherwise known as ELF, which does things like rip ivy off of trees that have been left on too long and deliver people strange things anonymously, that kind of thing, which I find very, very fun. And I urge others to join this little known insurrection. It's not yet a militia, but I could be persuaded to carry arms of some type.
At least pitchforks and gardening trowels to get
that. That's right. I heard today on some news thing that somebody was, one of the Republicans, were declaiming the idea of an armed insurrection because there were so few guns being carried. I thought that was funny.
Yes.
But my second insurrection is forbidden hugs. So I will walk straight up to people and say, turn your head, and I will hug them and say, heart to heart, don't breathe on me. And that gets me through that filling up of my tank that I feel like I need hormonally and lovingly. I don't really want to be alive in an area where, in a, you know, period of time where we can't hug, we can't worship, we can't sing, we can't gather. I mean, really, a year of this is getting hard. And I know it's true for more than just me. So that's where I break the law. Jail me, I don't care.
Saw an interesting article, I think it was in the New York Times, about how to be intimate with people and not be face to face. So people are trying to figure it out. It's sort of like going back to being 16 and dating again. How do you do that?
Right. Close on.
one of my friends up on Lopez Island came up with the idea, you go back to back and then you kind of wiggle.
Ooh, I like that.
What is a Harry Belafonte song, back to back and belly to belly?
Yeah.
Don't give a damn because I've done that already.
Yeah, I love it.
Fantastic. So highly visible to us on our Zoom screens this morning is the erudite editor of Indivisible Vashon's weekly online newsletter for your consideration, Kevin Jones. Kevin, what is Indivisible Vashon planning to do to respond to the insurrection and to the obvious move of many state houses to limit people's right to vote?
Wow, that's a very tall order, but we are definitely got our thinking caps on. The first thing I do want to say is that previous discussion about different positions is not part of our 90 sex ed in school program. That will not be part of the curriculum. Just wanted to point that out. And to Truman's Army buddies, the durability of hard-won belief systems. You know, maybe we should make it okay to be wrong. in the future. So, you know, there's a lot of, as far as the insurrectionists, you know, there's a lot of rallying people around, we need these Republicans to go away. And some of those Republicans, like Mitch McConnell, you know, he might choose to go away next year, but, you know, he's got a pretty solid base there. So we're being a little more strategic to look at where the vulnerable seats are in 2022 and where we can maintain and the trifecta that we currently, you know, enjoy in the federal government. But we're also talking about the filibuster, because the two critical bills that will make a difference in terms of voter access, H.R. 1 and H.R. 4, need at least 60 votes or only 51 if the filibuster goes away. So those are some things that are in the hopper right now in our process.
Right. Kevin, for 25 of our 25 readers, listeners, can you explain the filibuster just a bit?
Briefly? So the filibuster is not a constitutionally mandated requirement. Bruce may be able to really amplify the history, but the brief history is that it was adopted in order to ensure the primacy of white men in terms of deciding how the government will run. And so it does, of course, have stability. It requires now 60 votes in the Senate to pass certain things. It's been eroded. Harry Reid removed that obligation for federal judges. And I believe the obligation for has been further weakened. I don't know if that was Supreme Court justices or not. So it can be removed, and piece by piece it actually has been. Now the question, now we have a tied Senate, is should we go back to the original plan where the Senate was a majority rule and not requiring a vote of 60? Previously, it was a supermajority of 67, I understand. So these are malleable rules that we choose how we govern ourselves. And many people are now seeing the filibuster as a real roadblock to progress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you.
It all traces back to, I mean, remember the origins of the American constitutional system was that you had a House of Representatives that was very reflective of the people. And so it's elected every 2 years. It originates all the bills that have to do with finance. It's really the voice of the people. The Senate was designed to be a moderating influence on that, to slow things down, in effect. And the filibuster was basically part of that, you know, so that things didn't just rush through. In the 18th century, 250 years ago, that was probably a wise thing to do, because it took sometimes weeks for senators or representatives to communicate with their constituents, because, they were hundreds of miles away. There was no telegraph, there was no telephone, no computers. In today's age, that's not as wise as it was 200 years ago. And also a number of states, I think two states, and a number of governments like New Zealand have abolished the Senate and gone to just one house, a unicameral legislature, which then becomes more reflective of the people. So there are things for us to consider there. Yeah, Lynn.
I have another question about that for you. I sometimes know a little about a lot and not enough in depth. So this question comes from that. I thought the filibuster had to also do with people getting up to speak, as long as they could stand on their feet to argue a particular case, like in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, that fabulous film. Can you explain that part of it?
Well, again, it was that sense of giving minorities a voice and allowing people to slow the process down. And that film, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, he stands on the floor for, 48, 54 hours, something like that, continuously talking. And the idea was that everybody has as much time as they need to express their opinion. Where it begins to abuse that is the sense that it allows people to slow down the process and basically stop the process. And so that's why, beginning with Harry Reid and others, we've incrementally sort of begun to remove that. But it's only a rule. It's only a Senate rule. I mean, it can be changed by a vote of the Senate, so it doesn't take a supermajority.
And to clarify, the way that you stop the filibuster is by that supermajority. That's the only way you can stop it, is if you have the supermajority says, exactly. Okay, you have to end it. Kevin. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the only other thing that I think it's important to add is that there are some who I've heard repeatedly, it's easy to get rid of the filibuster. All it takes is a majority vote. The difficulty is that there are two senators who have come out publicly and said, Democratic senators, who said that they are in favor of retaining the filibuster, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kristen Sinema of Arizona. And while it's tempting to think, oh, only two senators, that should be easy, those senators are pretty set in their position, and they're just the shield in front of maybe potentially many other senators who would also not be willing to vote to remove the filibuster. Dianne Feinstein is notably one of them, apparently, but there may be more. So it's not clear. It's a challenge to being able to move forward with restoring voting rights as we knew them before the Supreme Court weakened that statute, the Voting Rights Act. It is going to take a lot of influence from voters. So it's really important that we not only talk to our representatives, but we find people in other states who we can convince them to talk to their representatives as well.
Mm-hmm. Gail and then Truman.
Yeah, I just wanted to circle back to something you had mentioned, Bruce. Did you say it was New Zealand that abolished their Senate and went to a single house? I would love to see us do something like that, I think, because the Senate is such a disproportional representation system in this country, you know, where two senators can represent millions of people or only thousands of people. And hence it gives already an unfair advantage to some constituents than over others. And so I think that moving to something like that, I do think we need to rework our way of governing. And I think looking at something like what New Zealand did and how they did that, I'd be curious to know what was the impetus in that case for change.
I was just going to say it's related, exactly related to what you were saying. And that is that I thought that was pretty interesting that the people who voted the people who voted for impeachment represented 74 million some odd more than the people who voted not to impeach. Because of that disparity that you were talking about. I thought that was pretty interesting. I don't have the actual number, but I know that the difference is sizable. So.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, although it wasn't the two-thirds majority that the Constitution demands for a conviction in an impeachment trial, it was a majority. And it was a clear majority. We would call that a landslide if it was a presidential election. So I think it's important to remember that this is most legislators and elected officials did not want that to be let go and him to be let off on that.
And interesting that 57-43 vote is very close to the percentage in polls, at least, of people who felt that he should be impeached and those who felt that he shouldn't. So it is reflective of where we are. So let's move along. Bringing back from Orcas and Lopez Island perspective to our Vashon Island is futurist, writer, dreamcatcher, and peripatetic poet Gail Kellner. Gail, do you have some soothing words of poetry for us during these troubled times?
Oh, well, I was going to circle back a little with my poetry today towards the beginning of a program, noting that it was just 2 days after Valentine's Day. And a friend on Lopez called Valentine's Day the National Singles Awareness Day. If anyone's single, they know, our listeners that are single totally get what I'm talking about. And and then I found this wonderful poem with a little humor and quite a bit of depth in it by poet Vinslava Szymborska. She was she won the 1996 Nobel Prize for Literature, and she is a Polish woman. She passed away a couple of years ago, but lived into her 80s, wrote amazing poems. If anyone, I'm sorry, the spelling is quite complicated of her name, because it's about 57 consonants with two or three vowels only. Anyway, it's called A Thank You Note. So this is kind of a Valentine's thought for the morning. I owe a lot to those I do not love. Relief in accepting others, care for them more. Joy that I am not wolf to their sleep. I don't wait for them from window to door. I understand what love never could. I forgive what love never would. Between rendezvous and letter, no eternity passes. only a few weeks or days. Our trips always turn out well. Concerts are enjoyed, cathedrals toured, landscapes in focus. And when seven rivers and mountains come between us, are the rivers and mountains found on any map?
Mm-hmm. So sweet.
She's a marvelous poet. So that's Svenslava Szymborska. And she's wonderful. If anyone out there cares to look her up, many, many books of poems over a lifetime.
It reminds me of the new phrase, Gail, that I heard this last week, which is to remember Galentine's Day. In other words, gal as in women. For those of us who don't have either male partners in our lives or have to rely on our female friends for love and hugs.
Well, thank you, Gail. Well, appreciate that.
And you know, also, you know, the reason we were playing When the Saints Go Marching In today is Mardi Gras, Fat Tuesday.
Oh, yeah.
Fat Tuesday.
Yep, right? Today.
Fat Tuesday.
Yeah. My favorite holiday.
So I'm historian Bruce Holman, always struggling to make sense of the messy world we live in. And the events of the past 3 months, a little more than 3 months, I mean, when you reflect, I mean, it seems like the November election was a long time ago. So those 3 months, we've had time to reflect on where we're headed and sort of ask ourselves where we're headed as a democratic nation under the rule of law. Where did the briefly see us going? What's gonna spin out of this over the next 6 months, year, 5 years, 10 years? Any thoughts?
I have a quick one. I saw on Facebook this morning, which I shared on my page, which I thought was great, where you said that, did you see that President Biden approved immediately emergency aid to Texas, who did not vote for him, and he didn't even require them to say something nice about him? It's so nice to have an adult in the White House again.
I think that is... Truman, a wonderful example, you know, for my general observation, which is I think we're going to see relief at a return to something more normal. And I think that is, you know, one of the great things that a president does bring, whether, you know, it's like number 45 who brought chaos and division, a president has a tremendous amount of power in the very presence and in their message and behavior. And Biden is a gentleman above all else. And I think that he is genuinely compassionate and genuinely wants to serve. And I think that this will change the tone in our country over the next few years.
Sure, Kevin.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, for those of us who follow the Democratic Party and the steps that the president has already taken just in these last several months, we pretty much know where Joe Biden wants to take this country. He wants to address COVID. He wants to get kids back in school. He wants to get people back at work. He wants to get our economy moving. He wants to restore our relationships with allies on the global stage. The thing that is not at all clear to me is where the Republican Party is going right now. Clearly, with the numbers of Republicans who did not vote for impeachment, including former Speaker McConnell, who clearly saw that the president was guilty of an insurrection against our government. There's still a lot of people who are not willing to put their votes in that space, but there's a division, all right, that's occurring. It's not clear to me whether those fracture lines will be temporary or whether those fracture lines will propagate. I think we have to just wait and see.
Lynn.
I have two thoughts, I'll try to be succinct, that relate to exactly what Kevin just said. I've been reading a history book by Jacques Barzon, who's French but holds the history chair at Columbia University, who has some very interesting thematic ideas about history. And he talks about that there's two themes running constantly through Western civilization for the last 500 years. One has been emancipation, you know, from constrictions and stereotypes, and one being primitivism, in which individuals who are not benefiting from that emancipation or who are threatened by those emancipations are in conflict with the purposes of emancipation, and that those cycles have echoed throughout history. It actually gave me a little more understanding and sympathy for what happened at the Capitol. Not that I endorse violence, because I don't, but Barzun also quotes Aristotle in his work Politics, who said that the only basis or the main basis for a functioning democracy is to have a large middle class flanked by a few rich people and only a few poor people. And I think we have got to remember we are in the biggest period of economic inequity since the 1890s. And if that doesn't start changing in some way, I would expect to see more insurrection and more unrest.
Gail?
I would just add, I'm not sure what Aristotle was thinking when he said that we needed anything but a middle class, honestly. I'm not sure what the need is for poor people or what the need is for ultra rich. I would question Aristotle himself on that, were he on the program.
Well, I may have
started. We'll invite him next week.
Let me correct myself. I may not have quoted him perfectly, but I don't think he was advocating for rich and poor. He was advocating for a middle class and probably saying the poor and the rich will always be with us, that kind of thing.
Well, at any rate, I certainly agree that that there is a huge importance in having a middle class and a large, robust middle class at that. And I think that one of the things Biden is holding on to, though he's getting some pushback, is the $15 an hour minimum wage. And I think that this is probably one of the most important things that we need to go forward on, is moving that minimum wage up. It is currently the minimum wage is just a little over $7 an hour. I don't know how anyone thinks that anyone can live on that kind of money. It's at $15 an hour at full time is still a very marginal living. And I think that is something that he is addressing. I'm really happy to see that.
Did you know that the minimum wage was started in the 1950s, I believe, and it was tied, the amount of it was tied to the cost of food in the 1950s. And it's been long known, at least in social work circumstances, that even a higher minimum wage is not going to touch what it takes to really thrive in our economy. That's more like $35 an hour, according to Diana Pierce, who researches this exact thing, the difference between poverty wages and the maintenance of poverty by having very low wages, and us not being able so far to rein the monies that do float to the top, as you mentioned, Gail.
Mm-hmm. And it makes me question, what is the purpose of having this really underclass, other than to have them serve, you know, the upper classes, so that you can have someone that you don't have to pay very much to, you know, do the cleaning, to do the menial chores that exist in any society. And I think that there's something to be said to be paying everyone fairly, and maybe perhaps particularly those who have been underpaid historically, including women and minorities.
Kevin, any thoughts?
Well, I certainly agree that economic prosperity has to exist in a society to avoid violence in the society. When people see that they have few options for survival, they choose options that we'd rather them they not choose. thievery and other illegal commerce are just other examples of that can happen. So I certainly think economic equity. I do think that the very likely that the additional $1,400 stimulus checks will be provided. I think it's reasonable that folks who were benefited during the previous administration share in benefits from this administration. So I think that's an equity thing, as well as was pointed out very clearly by our Congresswoman the other day, that all the data that you might use to figure out how to, adjudicate where that money goes is 2 years old, because folks are now out of work and their income tax and their earnings, the last data point we have is now stale. We just don't know who's suffering. So I do think it's important to be supportive and provide that economic equity that Gail and Lynn are talking about.
I do want to say, though, I think that there is a need for the wealthy class and the poor. And the reason is because it gives the middle class something to shoot for. If they think, I can really, if I strive and I work and I can get to that goal, whether that's true or not is, of course, another thing. But I do think that gives them something to aim for. I really do. Go ahead, Gail.
Truman, I really appreciate you saying that, because I think that is a Republican perspective that it's important for Democrats to understand. And I agree with the aspect of it that it is, I think it is important that people have something to strive for and the opportunity to achieve something and models for what that looks like. However, what concerns me, of course, is that the people who are at the bottom of the income ladder, who are at the disadvantaged socially and or economically, literally do not have that opportunity. It's put in front of their faces. They are unable to reach for it because of lack of education, lack of capital, lack of family support, lack of any number of things, that quite a large variety of them. And then it's turned around on them, and people who have achieved this, usually because they have good education, good economic support, came from families that had money and support for them, say that they're either not trying hard enough, or they're lazy, or that they're incapable. And I think that it's their fault. And I think that's the problem that I get into personally about that. Go ahead, Truman.
Yeah, let me just tell you, I used to think exactly like that. And I have a young man, and this is a perfect example. I've seen this happen several times since. But a young man who was an incredibly hard worker used to come and work for me. And I just kept thinking, this poor guy just can't get a break. He is such a hard worker. And he's such a dedicated guy. He just hasn't had a break. And if he had a break, man, he would really take off, right? So I recommended him highly for a job. And he took that job, and he did the job really well, up until a point that he finally got mad and stormed off the thing and was fired. And guess what? He had a break. He had a tremendous break. But he himself screwed it up. I've seen that happen over and over again. You think, oh gosh, if those disadvantaged only had a break, they would be able to, get a hold of it. That is not always true at all. And I was astounded, to tell you the truth, the first time I saw that happen. But it happens a lot. Yeah, Kevin.
Yeah, and Lynn, at least you had your hand up, Lynn, if you wanted to go
you
first.
You go ahead.
Yeah, I know that it's always intriguing, because our mindset is framed by the direct experiences that we have, much like that. And it's the question that I would come back to is my lived experience representative? And it's hard for me to say that it is. I know what my lived experience, it speaks loudly to me, but it may speak only from a narrow data set. I think that in this conversation, I don't think anybody's saying that ideally that working hard, putting your best effort forward should create economic prosperity for the person doing the work. I think that's been a hallmark of this country. And people could come here from anywhere. If you worked hard, you could get ahead. And I think that we want to maintain that. I think the framing of this conversation in my mind is about economic opportunity and economic equity. And you can argue those things are in conflict, because in some sense they are. But we should definitely make way for, while we're worrying about economic equity and making sure that people have enough so that they don't become homeless and a burden on society, they don't expire prematurely or they don't have their kids in poverty and going hungry and turning to, not becoming, quote, productive in our society. I think it's important we have economic equity, but we also have the opportunity to move forward and beyond that. One of the challenges is those who don't feel economic opportunity in a way have their voices stolen from them in the electoral process. We already talked about the imbalance of the Senate and its representation. People with money have power and their voices are louder. They can set the agenda. If you read Democracy in Chains, I'll come back to that, funded by the Koch brothers, who were clearly very wealthy, their goal in that book is to ensure economic freedom. And economic freedom sounds great to everybody, but what it means for them is you can't tax my wealth unless I agree with it. The minority can decide who gets taxed. So in a sense, we have these voices that are taken away and people become disenfranchised with the system. And that does not support us in a democracy in the long haul. So sorry to take up so much time, but I thought
that's excellent.
No, I think that's really helpful, Kevin. And if I can kind of add a little more specificity, Truman, you almost completely described some of the social work text I've read about the differences between Republicans and Democrats, exactly as Gail and Kevin talked about. But to be more specific, if the Republican side is saying this is a matter of individualism, this individual should have been able to take advantage of that break. That's always been true, or let's say more true, for white people than for people of color. And they have not been given those breaks. And worse, they've had generational trauma. They've not had quality educations. They've not had familial generational wealth built up. So they have backups. And so both are true. Both perspectives are true. And where we get into trouble is how we apply this. Do we have a social democracy that's robust enough to provide better education, better economic opportunity, or do we leave it all to the individual? The social structures that Democrats have felt were important to the growth of our country. It's like the balancing scale of justice to me. It is not one or the other. It is how we go about balancing all of that and making more people eligible for the American dream. That's what I think.
Yeah, and to me, it seems like it comes down to it's a looking at it as a systems problem, how do we develop a system that allows individuals to be successful and to become the Jeff Bezos of the world? And yet, how do you also have a system that takes care of folks who can't be the just Jeff Bezos of the world? And should Jeff Bezos have more money than half the nations in the world, or should that money filter down through his organization to the people that made his success possible? You're dealing with systemic problems and systemic issues. And that's sort of the great experiment of the United States, is how do you form a democratic nation that has a rule of law, that takes care of citizens, and structures an economy that works in this complex kind of world. Truman?
Yeah, I was just going to say one of the processes that I've seen in business that I think is a brilliant thing, and that is that the profit sharing, and where you have the CEO is making a tremendous amount of money, but if the company does well, they share the profits with the people who are working. So that gives them all incentive to to make the company more successful, which of course makes a CEO more successful. But that sort of thing, I think, is really, really beneficial. And
exactly.
Would like to, and I mean, we had it in my company, and I think it's a great thing. Go ahead, Kevin.
You know, I'm very intrigued by the conversation, and particularly the introduction of Jeff Bezos. And like Bill Gates, you know, Jeff is now working to figure out how to distribute his billions and billions and billions of dollars. And there's very likely that very good things will come of that. But the question came to mind is, why is it Jeff who's the right guy to make that decision, right? His accumulated wealth is representative of not only the infrastructure developed by in this country, which under which he would not have been able to achieve those benefits. Clearly, he's a brilliant person, and clearly he's a good business head. But also clearly, you know, the country enabled him to achieve that wealth. And now it's his decision, one person's decision, how to distribute all of that revenue, all of that gross domestic product, if you will, that this country generated. Is that the right answer? I don't know.
Yeah, that's why I see it as a systemic problem. And it's sort of that, how do you foster people to be successful like Jeff Bezos, but also have him pay in effect for the infrastructure that, you know, the public provided for him to allow him to become what he has become. There's got to be a payback for that kind of thing.
As a longtime educator, we used to joke around that we should sell our students when they graduate.
You should what? Sell your students?
We should sell our students.
Oh, that's a good idea. That's a good idea. You know, depends on how well you did, how much you could get for them, right?
Yeah.
How we that can support our schools, because we've that's made right. a tremendous investment.
That's a good plan.
I want to just say one last thing, and it's a subtle point on one hand, and on the other hand, it speaks volumes to me with regard to what you're talking about. Is it a systemic issue, equality and opportunity, or is it an individual's issue? So we say things like, well, someone got a break. Why does someone have to have a break in order to succeed? Shouldn't success be built in? Because I know that certainly if you are a person of higher social economic standing, you don't wait for a break. You have a whole lifetime of support underneath you. So the chances of you succeeding are far, far greater than someone who has to wait for a break, who has to be there in the right moment, who has to make the right decision quickly and not lose their temper. God forbid they lose their temper, you know, which is something that I think we don't understand. I mean, a lot of times when people are losing their temper in some situation or another is because they feel there's an inequity happening. There's something going on, or maybe that there is a personal issue, but they don't have that support underneath them.
Go on. I got one. I don't know if I'm going to have time to get this out. We've only got a minute to go here, but I have to tell you, I've had more people, successful people, tell me, gee, I just happened to be at the right place at the right time. And I finally came to the understanding that that is absolutely not true. That there are three things that have to occur for that to work. And the first is that you have to recognize, hey, this is an opportunity. That's the first thing. The second thing is you have to have some kind of a background that would allow you to take advantage of that opportunity. And the third and the most important factor of that is you must be willing to take a risk in order to achieve that, whatever that is. And I've seen this happen over and over and over again, where there a person had an opportunity to do something, but they were afraid to take the step that would get them to that point. And they were afraid to quit a job that, you know, that they were relying on or something. But hey, guys, we're out of time. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have ended with that. Let's come back to that next time.
Bruce, do you have last words for us? Thank you.
Okay. See you guys next week.
Thank you, everyone. Stay warm.
Absolutely.